Class is now in session. Welcome to Ed History 101. I am your host, Jennifer.
And I am Paul.
And Paul, you know this is all about you.
Of course it is.
So I'm going to read you a quote, and I want you to tell me how it relates to your high school experience. Does it sound familiar?
Lay it on me.
Okay. Quote, bells would ring, and just as with Pavlov's salivating dog, children would shift out of their seats and lurch toward yet another class.
I would say that lines up perfectly with what I remember.
And that is the exact opposite of what I remember. See, I remember skipping gleefully down the hallway. I remember thinking, I get to now go do this other exciting thing. So yes, another reminder that context matters a lot in our school experiences.
Yes.
So I suppose one might say your high school experience was kind of robotic and factory-like.
You could. Yes, you could say that.
So if I were to tell you that schools were created to, quote, serve industry, they were modeled after industry with factory-like assembly lines, with standardized tests created to standardize workers, most of them interchangeable, that the factory whistle was replaced with a school bell, yet the function remains the same. Would that sound familiar? Would you believe that?
I would believe that.
Would you believe me if I told you that's inaccurate?
Yes.
I would hope so. Otherwise, we might have to pause recording to have some conversations. One of the challenges is when we look back in the past, we tend to skew education history through the modern lens. And so we're going to talk today about bells. And I want to use bells to explore that there is no one truth. The system is giant, and it had a bunch of different forms and a bunch of different looks. So the second quote I shared with you was from an unschooling blog. And the goal of the blog post was to persuade parents to pull their children out of public school. And they're saying you should pull your child out of public school because schools are built to be like factories, which makes sense. Like, it feels that way. I mean, you lurched from class to class, and you weren't alone. I mean, you had...
No, there were hundreds of us
lurching,
walking through the halls like zombies. So,
I was reading a couple weeks ago this really interesting book called The End of Average by Todd Rose, and he's a Harvard researcher. And it's a really interesting book because he talks about this concept of average, and as it is, centered on white male...
As it
white is. Men of European descent. This whole idea of average is a huge misnomer, and he does some great stuff talking about how we should shift towards competency. Competency-based education as opposed to time-served education. And, but to support his claim, he talks about something called the Gary Plan. And he says, quote, groups of students rotated through different classes, each lasting a standardized period of time. School bells were introduced to emulate factory bells in order to mentally prepare children for their future careers. And the problem with what Todd Rose did is he cited a source by the name of James Taylor Gatto. James Taylor Gatto had that first quote that I read to you about Pavlov's bell and children lurching. James Taylor Gatto wrote the Underground History of American Education, but he doesn't cite a single source. He doesn't use footnotes, he doesn't use endnotes, nothing. He will occasionally reference a document, but he doesn't cite things. The guy who was saying schools are built like factories also said, and I quote, that when he was a young man, Thomas Jefferson was put in charge of a large plantation and 250 employees.
That's a odd use of the word employees.
Yes. If a historian is going to call enslaved people employees.
Yeah.
Why should we trust him when he says schools were based on the factory model?
Right. Because...
Yeah. So it's a little disconcerting that Rose uses as a citation a guy who calls enslaved people employees. And it's a narrative that's very popular. You can search for the factory model or the industrial era model. And my favorite, which apparently is used by architects, bells and cells model.
Oh, I like that.
Isn't that great? Bells and cells. But before we get into the history of bells, I want to share a really great text by Audrey Waters called The Invented History of the Factory Model. And I link to it on our website at history101.com on our show notes. And she goes through all the different ways people use the myth, and she breaks down why it's wrong. And what she says is that schools might feel highly depersonalized, they might routinely demand compliance and frequently squelch creativity, but they don't really look like and they don't really work like factories. So she also cites a historian by the name of Sherman Dorn, who was writing, I really enjoy reading, and he talks about we have to be careful not to be careless with education history.
We're careless with all our history, so
why should this be any different?
Yeah. Let's talk about the bell.
The humble little bell.
The humble bell.
And Horace Mann.
Because you can't talk about anything without talking about Horace Mann.
Gotta bring in Horace Mann. He was the man. The original education superhero. So he went on a field trip to Prussia.
To Prussia.
Which you know about.
Well.
It is all about you.
It's all about me.
And that's where your people come from.
That's where my people come from.
We also know about Russia because that's where Princess Sophie came from. And everybody knows who Princess Sophie ended up becoming.
Okay. Everybody except me.
Catherine II of Russia.
Oh.
Which I learned about in global studies in high school. One of us paid attention.
Yeah, one of us did.
Yeah.
And it probably wasn't me.
So he went to Prussia. And when he came back, he had ideas. And one of his ideas was that teachers should be equipped to do their job. They should have all things. Yes. And he had this crazy idea. You want to hear this totally crazy idea he had?
Yes.
Teachers should be trained to do their jobs.
That's ridiculous.
I know. I see the shock on your face. I appreciate that shock on your face.
You're speechless.
Yes. It was a novel idea. On his list of things that school teachers needed to have were things like chairs with backs.
Really? A chair.
Big deal. They should have mats in front of the front door so people could scrape the mud off their feet.
No dirty feet.
A blackboard. They should have textbooks. And a bell.
And a bell.
His defense for schools having bells was teaching children punctuality. And one of the things that he said is, oh, some of our schools in Massachusetts already have a clock. And that clock strikes at stated intervals, like when people start recitation and when recitation class is over. So schools already had bells and clocks and chimes telling when things are supposed to happen. Kids went to lunch at a certain time. Like, it wasn't just, okay, I'm hungry, I'm going to go home and eat now. It was go home and eat. And then when lunch period was over, they'd ring the bell, kids would come back. So bells were already a part of school. Long before man went off and did his thing. But when he came back, he advocated more. So the common school movement is going along. More schools are being built. And presence of bells wasn't just on the East Coast of the common schools. It was also in Texas. I found, because I'm getting really good at this Googling thing, in 1893, a Texas school journal talked about a teacher meeting with parents before the first chime of the school bell.
Hmm.
So they were around. Also in 1893, I found something written by Millicent Washburn Shinn. She was the first woman to receive a doctorate from University of California, Berkeley.
Outstanding.
She's a child psychologist, and she wrote this whole profile of a little girl, and she was watching a little girl play. And then in the middle of the day, the little girl heard the pealing of a bell from a school more than a mile away and cried out, "I hear the cool bell." That's actually what she wrote in her notes. "I hear the cool bell."
Nice.
Yes. So there were cool bells. Things started to change as we head in the new century. So you remember the Committee of 10 White Dudes?
Yes.
I added, your host, Jennifer, added the white dude part. They were called the 10 of them. There were 10 of them. They were white. They were dudes. But the new group I'm going to introduce you to, they don't need any elaboration from me. They went all in on the whole who they were thing. They were called the National Society of Efficiency Men.
The National Society of Efficiency Men.
Yes.
That's awesome.
I didn't get their names. So, and I couldn't look at their pictures. I couldn't infer any racial cues.
I suspect.
Yes. See, back in this period of time, there were people, well, men called schoolmen. No schoolwomen. Actually, when you type into Word, schoolmen is not underlined as a misspelling. Schoolwomen is.
Well, that's because men are people.
And women are women. So the cool thing was, at this period of time, everyone who was anyone was into this hot new trend. Brace yourself. This is cool. You ready?
I'm ready.
Efficiency.
Efficiency.
Anyone who was anyone was all about making things more efficient. So there was this guy named Taylor. You may have heard of Taylorism. It was all about how quickly can we get men to carry this big giant block of iron from here to here. And if the math says they can do this many things, then they should be able to.
And bean counters were born.
Out of this whole thing, let's make everything crazy efficient. So school was no exception. And just like has happened before and has happened since and will keep on happening, the public was complaining about school. But this time they had a new argument. Before was, you know, their kids weren't getting the right kind of education and a couple of things were going on. But now they're saying you're wasting taxpayers' dollars.
No, can't have that.
So there's this kind of rising crescendo of complaints about how tax dollars are being used. There is the rising interest in efficiency. Smack in the middle is education. In 1912, there was a conference. And I'm going to read to you some of the conference titles that these schoolmen attended. By what standards or tests shall the efficiency of a school or system of schools be measured? Progress in standardizing the measurement of composition. Securing and maintaining efficiency in the teaching force of normal schools. A study in adolescent efficiency. Which I think is a fantastic oxymoron.
Yeah.
How do you get adolescents to be efficient?
The study in the least efficient things being efficient.
Yes. But it wasn't just administrators. Teachers also bought into scientific management. How can we be thoughtful and scientific about how we do our daily lives? So there was another session at a conference called, quote, "The Principles of Scientific Management Applied to Teaching Music in the Public Schools." I love it. Because it is the least like efficient, countable thing. But the music teacher, and this is what makes teachers so amazing, is the administrators are all about, let's make everything efficient. Let's, you know, count. And the janitor had a list of efficiency things. It was fantastic. And I mean that in the kind of hyperbolic, isn't this interesting to talk about thing. But this music teacher said, you can't be efficient about music appreciation and performance. It's only for sight reading.
So everybody else can be efficient.
Yes, but...
leave me alone.
Yes, stay away from, you know, stay away with your charts when it comes to music appreciation. But I don't want to kind of suggest that it was just a particular group of teachers. And I can't stress enough how everybody was into efficiency. One of the books I read about this called it The Cult of Efficiency. So to show you how deep this cult idea went, in 1913, two groups of English teachers got together and they did a joint study. They had over 1,000 English teachers from across the country and they tried to figure out how to make schools more efficient. And they overwhelmingly agreed that schools were currently unsatisfactory. No one was happy with how kids were writing. Where have we heard that before? They were not career nor college ready. So they concluded the average English teacher could read 2,000 words per hour. Anything more than that, and if they did it for more than 2 hours a day or 10 hours a week, do you want to hear what would happen?
Oh, please.
I shall lay these upon you. Brace yourself.
Is anyone vexed?
There is vexing. Ugh. Oh, there is vexing.
Of course there is.
There is vexing. Their concerns included being overstrained, hopelessly weary and discouraged, completely exhausted. Some proposed to give up English forever, and they suffered from nerves, nervous prostration, and became physical wrecks. Some reported they suffered from indigestion, and their eyesight was impaired. They would break down and, quote, find their way to the hospital or cemetery.
Wow. My teachers really didn't want to give me homework any more than I wanted to do it.
Exactly. Teachers haven't wanted to read Homer for a long period of time. But now, Paul, I want you to imagine that you are a schoolman, an administrator.
I'm a schoolman.
Yes.
My schoolman voice.
You are in charge of a school. And you get this report written by 1,000 English teachers. And they are talking that they're being so inefficient, they're going to die. Like, because, that's what they wrote. And one of the reports said, quote, these statements may seem extreme to others who are not composition teachers, but we include these quotes because they are made over the signatures of men and women who mean exactly what they say, and because the members of this committee can cite parallel instances from their own personal lives.
Believe me when I say this, because I saw it happen.
Yes, somewhere. Do you see the ink stain on my fingers? So you are a schoolman. At the same time, you have thousands of teachers saying this current system is ineffective. We're dying because of it. You're getting more kids.
We need to fix it.
You need to fix it.
We need to fix it.
So who are you going to turn to? Not Ghostbusters, unfortunately.
Man. Why you gotta step on my joke like that? It's not right. You know me too well. You knew that joke was coming.
I saw the G forming. I'm sorry. Okay, so you can't turn to Ghostbusters. Instead, you have to turn to the efficiency experts.
I have to turn to the efficiency experts.
Because they know what they're talking about. And do you know where the efficiency experts learned how to be efficient? Factories. The industrial era. So a lot of these experts wanted to be hired by schoolmen. So they would write these big persuasive kind of speeches to assert they knew their stuff. And they would say things like, in the school, the children are the raw goods. And an administrator is like a factory overseer. So they would use factory analogies to talk about schools. Not because schools were like factories, but because they wanted to persuade schoolmen to hire them to come in and make their schools better. So a lot of the quotes that people take out of history, where someone literally said, children are the raw goods of school. I don't want to say it's used out of context, because that's the context.
That's what he said.
That's what he said. But the intent wasn't to say, this is how we have to build schools, is that we've got these things called schools that aren't working well. Let's look to another industry to make them work better. And these efficiency guys measured everything.
Everything.
From how long children should stand in line, and how long transition time should take, and math tests, and spelling tests, and the janitor. And one expert did a whole study about whether it's faster for a teacher to carry around a satchel full of blank paper with pencils or to leave it in one spot in the classroom for kids to go and get paper. So they took this stuff very seriously. And it sounds as if, on one hand, this stuff was very bad for education. But on the other hand, they also insisted on being efficient with the little...
the children.
I know, right?
The widgets?
Yeah, because of the widgets. Fantastic. The widgets needed to be able to see the board.
Well, yeah.
If the widgets were defective, The school wasn't being efficient. They brought along eye tests. So kids who were in public schools were getting eye tests for the first time. They started to talk about differentiated instruction. If you have a widget, which is kind of awkward to say, but if you have a widget that isn't quite on par, you help that widget get better. So a part of being efficient, a lot of districts and school systems would do what were called surveys. And these surveys, a swarm of experts. One teacher wrote about how she could barely turn around in her classroom without running into an efficiency man. They were everywhere. And it was this group of guys. When you called up one and said, yes, I'm a school man and I need a reference for an efficiency, they would recommend their friends. And in return, the friends would recommend their other friends. So it was the same group of guys going around the country.
So we do.
Yes. Yeah. I think, but I'm not 100% sure, but I think these may be the first example of consultants coming into schools. Now, these surveys that happened, they would say, okay, you're spending too much time here, too much time there. And some of the things they would look at buttressed up the sexist and racist nature of public education. So, for example, one report said that it was a waste of time for girls to study algebra and chemistry and physics. And instead, one expert recommended that girls should be studying the bacteriology of the household. That's the word, bacteriology.
Awesome.
That would be in the report. And in some of the instances, and remember at this point, this is before there was widespread desegregation. So this was just before World War I. There would be a white school and there would be a black school. So they would walk into the white school and they say, why are you having girls do this? Why are you spending time on that? And then they would go to the black school and they look around and they would see there were no books. It was freezing in the winter. It was roasting in the summer. Not a lot of resources, and say, yep, looks good. Moving on. But to be clear, teachers were complaining and they were ignored. Just to remind you, the name of the society, the National Society of Efficiency Men. So this is just before World War I. 80% of the teaching force is female. And they were saying, this isn't going to work. You're doing more harm than good. And they were ignored.
Because the efficiency men.
Yes. It would be inefficient to stop and listen to those actually teaching children.
Because they're not people.
Exactly. Man, why do I keep forgetting that?
I don't know.
So things are trying to get all up efficient in here. It wasn't all good or all bad. What was also happening for the first time is they were really talking about the school building. So it feels like it's been a while since we talked about bells.
Yeah, it does.
So one of the other things that buildings made of wood, shoddily made in cities, were prone to do was burn. And if you have a building full of children and there's a possibility that your building may burn, you want a way to alert children to get out of the building.
Bells.
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 Bells. So it became state law that schools had to have bells to be used as alarm systems. An organization began about 1921 called the National Council on Schoolhouse Construction. And their goal was to make schools more safe and less burning, which seems
a pretty good goal.
Kind of important thing. They've been thinking and talking about how to make schools a better place. And one of their initial reports, they said, currently many schools are, quote, factory-like, dark, and dank. So they wanted to make schools a better and brighter place. So now we have bells in schools for fire codes. We have bells in schools to tell kids when to start. We have bells in school to bring them back from lunch. We have had bells in schools for a very long period of time. Now we're going to go to Gary, Indiana, and talk about a new way that bells were going to be used. Remember Horace Mann?
I do.
I'm going to introduce you to a new superhero.
A new superhero.
Yes. His name is John Dewey.
John Dewey.
And Horace Mann, his basic philosophy was educate all the kids. Build common schools so kids have a common school experience with a core.
Around a core of education. Around a
core of education.
I've heard this before.
Yes, it's good. Because it's good for society.
Yes.
John Dewey came along and said, hey, you remember those little small human beings that are inside those schools?
The children?
Yeah.
Nobody cares about them.
It's a novel idea. He said, let's try and make it so school isn't a terrible, horrible experience for them. Let's try and make schools child-friendly. And it was called the Progressive Movement. He was a feminist, and he's also a founding member of the NAACP. So bonus points for intersectionality. So John Dewey was a pretty solid, decent guy.
He was a progressive.
Yeah, he was. He was a progressive guy all around. And one of his former students was hired to go to Gary, Indiana as a superintendent. And he built a school campus that was open, and there was a farm and there was a garden and it had labs and had music studios and had all sorts of gorgeous stuff. The guy's name was Wirt, and Wirt brought with him two things. First was Dewey's focus on progressive education and being child-centered. And second was being the most efficient school district in the country. He wanted to be the efficientest school. The most efficient school ever. So his idea was to start with thinking about using the whole school at the same time. So having kids in the classroom at the same time there were kids in the laboratory or kids in the music studio. This was a novel concept, and he called it the work-study-play plan, sometimes called the Geary plan, but sometimes called the platoon plan. Because it was a new idea, he had to borrow language. He borrowed it from the military. So he would have platoons of kids. The way his plan worked is that half the kids, he would split the school into two groups, let's say school A and school B. School A would be in the academic classroom. School B would be in the art studio or working in the drawing in the shops. And at the end of a period of time, they would switch. Now, we're talking here about thousands of kids. If you want to effectively communicate with thousands of kids,
you need a bell.
They started to use bells to indicate that it was time for kids to rotate. And when the kids were rotating, they were playing. They were, one woman wrote a story how she kept getting lost at school because during the playtime, they could do whatever they wanted. They could run. They could, you know, they had playgrounds. They had the garden. They did all these amazing different things. And what is so utterly fascinating is that how people looked at it was so different based on their experiences. If you were a progressive educator, you saw it as highly child-friendly because kids were getting all of these different experiences. They were doing all of these fun different things. One mother wrote about how dismayed she was to see children marching in straight lines from place to place. But at the same time, if you need to move a large number of people from place to place, it's easier to have them
in a straight line
walk in a straight line, especially when they're small humans who, you know,
wander.
You can at least keep your eye on the kids to make sure they're all safe. So all of the moves that weren't made to create this child-friendly, let's be efficient system are what people point to and say, that's the factory model. But that wasn't what his intention was, and that wasn't how it was used. And you don't even have to trust me on this. You can trust John Dewey. And John Dewey saw what was happening about the Geary plan. Things were going well. The children of Geary seemed to be doing well. They were managing the huge number of kids coming in. It appeared to be highly efficient. Things appeared to be going well, and the trend was catching on across the country. And whenever a trend catches on, there's oftentimes a backlash. And Dewey was dismayed by the backlash. And so in one of his papers, John Dewey, in 1914, he wrote about, so this is still the height of the efficiency cult. Dewey said, quote, "In these places, the aim has not been to turn schools into preliminary factories supported public expense, but to borrow from shops the resources and motives which make teaching more effective and wider in reach." And I was kind of excited when I read that. I may have fallen off the couch, I think. I was very excited because schools were not about turning them into factories. The bells were not about zombifying kids. It was about moving large group of kids through the different cycles of the work, study, play model. Now, I don't know exactly at what point it got down to 42 minutes. I suspect the answer to that lies in the Carnegie Unit, which is another podcast we'll do. We talked about the exams for graduation. We talked about being 17. There's a third part of graduation we have to talk about called course credit. So you have to take and pass a certain number of courses. So I think that's where the 42-minute thing comes in, where you have X number of hours a day, you have to get X number of credits, you do the math. And I suspect that's a holdover from the efficiency movement. But I will know more when I do research for another podcast.
And I will learn it when we do the podcast.
So, if we were to ask for whom the bell tolls, for you, Paul.
Well, of course.
It's all about you. Me. So, bells have always been used in schools to communicate. Sometimes they were used to start the day, to break kids for lunch, to bring kids back from lunch. They were used as safety mechanisms. They have always been used because bells are the most efficient way to communicate with a large group of people at the same time. Schools now are starting to turn off the bells. And I'm sure you remember that in your high school classes when the bell rang, I suspect you were out of there.
See ya.
That's a huge difference between us. Like if your teacher was in the middle of a sentence.
I didn't care.
And the bell rang, you
Not
were just.
Not one bit.
You were out of there.
I was free to go.
You felt no remorse about walking away from.
None whatsoever.
Man.
Bye.
Wow. Such a different experience. There's been bells and clocks and chimes in schools forever. It's not because of the factory model, and it's not because they were training kids to be in a factory. That's not where they came from. My hope is, as a result of this podcast, when people hear school bells or they think about school bells, they think about Wirt and his desire to create the work, study, play model. So kids were doing a whole bunch of creative things in school in addition to their academic. Unfortunately, though, people now think of Gatto. And what they think of is he referred to bells as the barren experience of school bells in a prison of measured time.
bells and cells.
Which was not their original intent. So bells were happy. Bells were, yay, it's time to go play. And I don't know how we change people's mindset around the factory myth. I would recommend they read Audrey's piece. It's fantastic. And whenever possible, to advocate for the work-study play model as opposed to the quotes where people say kids are widgets in a factory. Are you ready for your pop quiz?
I'm ready.
All right, I'm going to read you two quotes.
Two quotes.
And I want you to tell me which one was said in 2010. The law of initiative fatigue states that when the number of initiatives increases while time, resources, and emotional energy are constant, then each new initiative, no matter how well-conceived or well-intended, will receive fewer minutes, dollars, and ounces of emotional energy than its predecessors. So the more things you ask teachers to do, the less they'll be able to do it.
That was not said in 2010.
Here's the other quote. These new initiatives usually run a regular course that involves three stages. In the first stage, everything done before is wrong. In the second stage, if the new theory receives popular support, everything will be great, as the new idea will fix all of the problems. In the third stage, experienced teachers have distilled the initiative down to its useful kernel of truth and are using it without all of the trappings.
That was 2010.
That was 1916. So the first quote was said by Doug Reeves in 2010. The second quote was said by William Maxwell in 1916.
Wow.
Oh, it's the plus ça change, the more they stay the same. There is a second part to your pop quiz today.
Oh.
Because the cult of efficiency. God, it's hooks into me.
The cult of efficiency.
Yes. Would you like to know if you're an efficient student?
Would I like to know if I was an efficient student?
Yes.
I suspect someone would be happy to give me the answer.
So I'm going to ask you questions, and each question represents a degree of your efficiency as a student. So this is called the Student Efficiency Test from May 1915. I'm going to ask you a question, and depending on your answer, I will award you percentage points towards your efficiency score. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Number one, do you take joy in your schoolwork?
Answering as an eighth grader, no.
You've just lost 5 efficiency percentage points.
It's terrible.
Can you finish your lesson in 2 hours home study?
Yes.
2%. You just earned 2% of your efficiency points.
-3.
When you are mentally tired, do you take physical exercise in the open air? You go for a brisk walk when you're tired?
No, I sleep.
Then you just lost 3 percentage points.
But if I'm tired...
Do you sleep with at least one window open?
I grew up in Western New York. Not always. In the winter, no.
Do you study by a good light from behind or over your left shoulder? Because goodness knows you are not left-handed if there's a light behind you.
It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Do you read newspapers?
No.
3%. Do you read magazines?
No.
There goes 2%. Do you read good books?
Well, I think they're good if I'm reading them.
There goes another 3%. Do you keep up a correspondence with some sympathetic friend or relative?
What?
Have you a bank account?
Well, now, yes. In eighth grade, probably not.
Do you loaf on the streets?
Yes. This is a very hostile test. I'm not sure I like this.
Have you one special friend of your own sex?
I'm pretty sure in eighth grade all my friends were the same sex, except for the ones that weren't.
Do you attend and enjoy church?
No.
You are just losing points all over the place here.
What does church have to do with efficiency?
It's how efficient you are as a student.
But...
Are you proud of your report card as representing the best you are capable of?
No.
Have you a good hobby?
Yeah.
And the word hobby is in all caps.
Loafing in the streets.
I'm sorry, sir. I don't think you are efficient.
Not as an eighth grader. I was an eighth grader. That's a very hostile test.
Do you study the manners of other people, imitating the good and avoiding the bad that you see about you?
Well, as an eighth grader, I did the opposite. I studied the manners of people and imitated the bad.
Yeah.
Because that's...
I think we can reach the conclusion that you are not an efficient student.
I'm pretty sure we're in agreement.
All right. Class dismissed.